The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the 11th reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. I'm Anna McLean. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. Vianne and Sophie stand in queues all day but go home with very little. When she gets home, Beck tells her Rachel is in danger. There's a roundup the next day. That night, Vianne accompanies Rachel and her children to the free zone, but machine gun fire is heard and Sarah is shot. They manage to get her home, but she dies. Vianne buries her and hides Rachel and Ari in the barn. The next morning, the French police come for Rachel and Ari. They were nearly to the front door when a French police car pulled up out front. Paul got out of the car and strode into the yard, carrying his rifle. "Are you Rachel de Champlain?" he asked. Rachel frowned. "You know I am." "You are being deported. Come with me." Rachel tightened her hold on Ari. "Don't take my son." "He is not on the list," Paul said. Vianne grabbed the man's sleeve. "You can't do this, Paul. She is French." "She is a Jew." He pointed his rifle at Rachel. "Move." Rachel started to say something, but Paul silenced her. He grabbed her by the arm, yanked her out of the road, and forced her into the back seat of his automobile. Vianne meant to stay where she was, safe, intended to, but the next thing she knew, she was running alongside the automobile, banging on the bonnet, begging to be let inside. Paul slammed on the brakes, let her climb into the back seat, and then he stomped on the gas. "Go," Rachel said as they passed Le Jardin. "This is no place for you." "This is no place for anyone," Vianne said. Even a week ago, she might have let Rachel go alone. She might have turned away, with regret probably, and guilt certainly. But she would have thought that protecting Sophie was more important than anything else. Last night had changed her. She still felt fragile and frightened, maybe more so, but she was angry now, too. In town, there were barricades on a dozen streets. Police wagons were everywhere, disgorging people with yellow stars on their chests, herding them toward the train station where cattle cars waited. There were hundreds of people. They must have come from all the communes in the area. Paul parked and opened the car doors. Vianne and Rachel and Ari stepped into the crowd of Jewish women and children and old men making their way to the platform. A train waited, puffing black smoke into the already hot air. Two German soldiers were standing on the platform. One of them was Beck. He was holding a whip. A whip. But it was French police who were in charge of the roundup. They were forcing people into lines and shoving them onto the cattle cars. Men went into one cattle car, women and children in the other. Up ahead, a woman holding a baby tried to run. A gendarme shot her in the back. She pitched to the ground, dead. The baby rolled to the boots of the gendarme, holding a smoking gun. Rachel stopped, turned to Vianne. "Take my son," she whispered. The crowd jostled them. "Take him. Save him," Rachel pleaded. Vianne didn't hesitate. She knew now that no one could be neutral, not anymore, and as afraid as she was of risking Sophie's life, she was suddenly more afraid of letting her daughter grow up in a world where good people did nothing to stop evil, where a good woman could turn her back on a friend in need. She reached for the toddler, took him in her arms. "You," a gendarme stabbed Rachel in the shoulder with the butt of his rifle so hard she mumbled. "Move!" She looked at Vianne, and the universe of their friendship was in her eyes. The secrets they'd shared, the promises they'd made and kept, the dreams for their children that bound them as neatly as sisters. "Get out of here," Rachel cried hoarsely. "Go!" Vianne backed away. Before she knew it, she had turned and begun shoving her way through the crowd, away from the platform and the soldiers and the dogs, away from the smell of fear and the crack of whips and the sound of women wailing and babies crying. She didn't allow herself to slow until she reached the end of the platform. There, holding Ari closely, she turned around. Rachel stood in the black, yawning entrance of a cattle car, her face and hands still smeared with her daughter's blood. She scanned the crowd, saw Vianne, and raised her bloody hand in the air. And then she was gone, shoved back by the women stumbling in around her. The door to the cattle car clanged shut. Vian collapsed onto the divan. Ari was crying uncontrollably, and his diaper was wet, and he smelled of urine. She should get up, take care of him, do something, but she couldn't move. She felt weighed down by loss, suffocated by it. Sophie came into the living room. "Why do you have Ari?" she said in a quiet, frightened voice. "Where's Madame de Champlain?" "She is gone," Vian said. She hadn't the strength to fabricate a lie. And what was the good of one anyway? There was no way to protect her daughter from all of the evil around them. No way. Sophie would grow up knowing too much, knowing fear and loss and probably hatred. "Rachel was born in Romania," Vian said tightly. "That, along with being Jewish, was her crime. The Vichy government doesn't care that she has lived in France for 25 years and married a Frenchman and that he fought for France. So they deported her."
"Where will they take her?"
"I don't know."
"Will she come back after the war?"
"Yes, no, I hope so. What answer would a good mother give?"
"I hope so. And Ari?" Sophie asks.
"He will stay with us. He wasn't on the list. I guess our government believes children can raise themselves."
"But, Mama, what do we
do? What do we do?"
"I have no idea," she sighed.
"For now, you watch the baby. I'll go next door and get his crib and clothes."
Vian was almost to the door when Sophie said, "What about Captain Beck?"
Vian stopped dead. She remembered seeing him on the platform with a whip in his hand, a whip he cracked to herd women and children onto a cattle car.
"Oui," she said. "What about Captain Beck?"
Vian washed her blood-soaked clothes and hung them to dry in the backyard, trying not to notice how red the soapy water was when she splashed it across the grass. She made Sophie and Ari supper. What had she made? She couldn't remember. And put them to bed. But once the house was quiet and dark, she couldn't suppress her emotions. She was angry, howlingly so, and devastated. She couldn't stand how dark and ugly her thoughts were, how bottomless her anger and grief. She ripped the pretty lace from her collar and stumbled outside, remembering when Rachel had given her this blouse 3 years ago. "It's what everyone's wearing in Paris." The apple trees spread their arms above her. It took her 2 tries to tie the scrap of fabric to the knobby wooden branch between Antoine's and Sarah's, and when she'd done it, she stepped back. Sarah, Rachel, Antoine. The scraps of color blurred. That was when she realized she was crying. "Please, God," she began to pray, looking up at the bits of fabric and lace and yarn tied around the knobby branch, interspersed with unripe apples. What good were prayers now when her loved ones were gone? She heard a motorcycle come up the road and park outside Le Chardin. Moments later, "Madame?" She spun to face him.
"Where's your whip, Herr Captain?"
"You were there? How does it feel to whip a French woman?"
"You can't think I would do that, Madame. It sickens me."
"And yet, there you are. As were you. This war has put us all where we do not want to be. Less so for you Germans."
"I tried to help her," he said.
At that, Vian felt the rage go out of her, her grief return. He had tried to save Rachel, if only they had listened to him and kept her hidden longer. She swayed. Beck reached out and steadied her. "You said to hide her in the morning. She was in that terrible cellar all day. By afternoon, I thought, everything seemed normal." Von Richter adjusted the timetable. There was a problem with the trains. The trains. Rachel waving goodbye. Vian looked up at him. "Where are they taking her?" It was the first substantive question she'd ever asked him. "To a work camp in Germany." "I hid her all day," Vian said again, as if it mattered now. "The Wehrmacht aren't in control anymore. It's the Gestapo and the SS. They're more brutes than soldiers."
"Why were you there?"
"I was following orders. Where are her children?"
"Your Germans shot Sarah in the back at the frontier checkpoint."
"Oh, mein Gott," he muttered.
"I have her son. Why wasn't Ari on the list?"
"He was born in France and is under 14. They are not deporting French Jews." He looked at her.
"Yet."
Vian caught her breath.
"Will they come for Ari?"
"I believe that soon they will deport all Jews, regardless of age or place of birth. And when they do, it will become dangerous to have any Jew in your home."
"Children? Deported? Alone?" The horror of it was unbelievable, even after what she'd already seen. I promised Rachel I'd keep him safe. Will you turn me in? She asks. I am not a monster, Vianne. It was the first time he'd ever used a Christian name. He moved closer. I want to protect you, he said. It was the worst thing he could have said. She had felt lonely for years, but now she truly was alone. He touched her upper arm, almost a caress, and she felt it in every part of her body, like an electrical charge. Unable to help herself, she looked at him. He was close to her, just a kiss away. All she had to do was give him the slightest encouragement, a breath, a nod, a touch, and he would close the gap between them. For a moment, she forgot who she was and what had happened today. She longed to be soothed, to forget. She leaned the smallest bit forward, enough to smell his breath, feel it on her lips, and then she remembered, all at once, in a whoosh of anger, and she pushed him away so he stumbled. She scrubbed her lips as if they'd touched his. We can't, she said. Of course not. But when he looked at her, and she looked at him, they both knew that there was something worse than kissing the wrong person. It was wanting to. Chapter 24. Summer ended. Hot golden days gave way to washed-out skies and falling rain. Isabel was so focused on the escape route that she hardly noticed the change in weather. On a chilly October afternoon, she stepped out of the train carriage in a crowd of passengers, holding a bouquet of autumn flowers. As she walked up the boulevard, German motor cars clogged the street, honking loudly. Soldiers strode confidently among the cowed, drab Parisians. Swastika flags flapped in the wintry wind. She hurried down the metro steps. The tunnel was crowded with people and papered in Nazi propaganda that demonized the Brits and Jews and made the Führer the answer to every question. Suddenly, the air raid sirens howled. The electricity snapped off, plunging everyone into darkness. She heard people muttering and babies crying and all men coughing. From far away, she could hear the thump and grumble of explosions. It was probably Boulogne-Billancourt again. And why not? Renault was making lorries for the Germans. When the all-clear finally sounded, no one moved until moments later, when the electricity and lights came back on. Isabel was almost to the train when a whistle blared. She froze. Nazi soldiers, accompanied by French collaborators, moved through the tunnel, talking to one another, pointing at people, pulling them out to the perimeter, forcing them to their knees. A rifle appeared in front of her. "Papers," the German said. Isabel clutched the flowers in one hand and fumbled nervously with her purse with the other. She had a message for Anouk wrapped within the bouquet. It was not unexpected, of course, this search. Since the Allied successes in North Africa had begun, the Germans stopped people constantly, demanding papers. In the streets, the shops, the train stations, the churches, there was no safety anywhere. She handed over her false carte d'identité. I am meeting a friend of my mother's for lunch. The Frenchman sidled up to the German and perused the papers. He shook his head, and the German handed Isabel her papers and said, "Go." Isabel smiled quickly, nodded a thank you, and hurried for the train, slipping into an open carriage just as the doors slid shut. By the time she exited in the 16th arrondissement, her calm had returned. A wet fog clung to the streets, obscuring the buildings and the barges moving slowly on the Seine. Sounds were amplified by the haze, turned strange. Somewhere a ball was bouncing, probably boys playing in the street. One of the barges honked its horn, and the noise lingered. At the avenue, she turned the corner and went to a bistro, one of the few with its lights on. A nasty wind ruffled the awning. She passed the empty tables and went to the outside counter, where she ordered a café au lait, without coffee or milk, of course. "Juliette, is that you?" Isabel saw Anouk and smiled. "Gabrielle, how lovely to see you," Isabel handed Anouk the flowers. Anouk ordered a coffee. While I stood there, sipping coffee in the icy weather, Anouk said, "I spoke with my uncle Henri yesterday. He misses you." "Is he unwell?" "No, no, quite the opposite. He is planning a party for next Tuesday night. He asked me to extend an invitation." "Shall I take him a gift for you?" "No, but a letter would be nice. Here, I have it ready for you." Isabel took the letter and slipped it into the lining of her purse. Anouk looked at her. Smoky shadows circled her eyes. New lines had begun to crease her cheeks and brow. This life in the shadows had begun to take a toll on her. "Are you all right, my friend?" Isabel asked. Anouk's smile was tired but true. "Oui." She paused. "I saw Gaetan last night. He will be at the meeting in Carafo." "Why tell me?" "Isabel, you are the most transparent person I have ever met. Every thought and feeling you have reveals itself in your eyes. Are you unaware how often you have mentioned him to me?" "Really? I thought I had hidden it." "It's nice, actually. It reminds me of what we are fighting for. Simple things. A girl and a boy and their future." She kissed Isabel's cheeks. Then she whispered, "He mentions you as well." Luckily for Isabel, it was raining in Carafo on this late October day. No one paid attention to people in weather like this, not even the Germans. She flipped her hood up and held her coat shut at her throat. Even so, rain pelted her face and slid in cold streaks down her neck as she hauled her bicycle off the train and walked it across the platform. On the outskirts of town, she climbed aboard. Choosing a lesser-used alley, she pedaled into Carafo, bypassing the square. On a rainy autumn day like this, there were few people out and about, only women and children standing in food queues, their coats and hats dripping rainwater. The Germans were mostly inside. A bell jangled overhead, announcing her arrival to the German soldiers who were seated in the lobby, drinking their afternoon coffees. "Mademoiselle," one of the officers said, reaching for a flaky golden pound of chocolat, "you are soaking wet." "These French do not know enough to get out of the rain." They laughed at that. She kept smiling and walked past them. At the hotel's front desk, she rang the bell. Henri came out of the back room, holding a tray of coffees. He saw her and nodded. "One moment, madame," Henri said, gliding past her, carrying the tray to a table where two SS agents sat like spiders in their black uniforms. When Henri returned to the front desk, he said, "Madame Gervaise, welcome back. It is good to see you again. Your room is ready, of course, if you'll follow me." She nodded and followed Henri down the narrow hallway and up the stairs to the second floor. There he pressed a skeleton key into a lock, gave it a twist, and opened the door to reveal a small bedroom with a single bed, a nightstand, and a lamp. He led her inside, kicked the door shut with his foot, and took her in his arms. "Isabel," he said, pulling her close, "it is good to see you." He released her and stepped back. "With Romainville, I worried." Isabel lowered her wet hood. "Oui. In the past 2 months, the Nazis had cracked down on what they called saboteurs and resistors. They had finally begun to see the role women were playing in this war and had imprisoned more than 200 French women in Romainville." She unbuttoned her coat and draped it over the end of the bed. Reaching into the lining, she pulled out an envelope and handed it to Henri. "Here you go," she said, giving him money that had come from MI9. His hotel was one of the key safe houses their group maintained. Isabel loved that they housed Brits and Yanks and resistors right under the Nazis' noses. Tonight she would be a guest in this smallest of rooms. She pulled out a chair from behind a scarred writing desk and sat down. "The meeting is set for tonight, 11 p.m., in the abandoned barn on the Angela farm." "What's it about?" "I'm not in the know." He sat down on the end of the bed. She could tell by the look on his face that he was going to get serious, and she groaned. "I hear the Nazis are desperate to find the Nightingale. Word is that they're trying to infiltrate the escape route." "I know this, Henri." She lifted one eyebrow. "I hope you are not going to tell me that it's dangerous." "You are going too often, Isabel. How many trips have you made?" 24. Henri shook his head. "No wonder they are desperate to find you. We hear word of another escape route running through Marseille and Papillon that is having success, too. There is going to be trouble, Isabel." She was surprised by how much his concern moved her and how nice it was to hear her own name. It felt good to be Isabel Rossignol again, even if only for a few moments, and to sit with someone who knew her. So much of her life was spent hiding and on the run, in safe houses with strangers. Still, she saw no reason to talk about this. The escape route was invaluable and worth the risk they were taking. "You are keeping an eye on my sister, oui?" "Oui." The Nazi still billets there? Henri's gaze slid away from hers.
What is it?
Vianne was fired from her teaching post some time ago.
Why? Her students love her. She's an excellent teacher.
The rumor is that she questioned a Gestapo officer.
That doesn't sound like Vianne. So she has no income. What is she living on?
Henri looked uncomfortable. There's gossip.
Gossip?
About her and the Nazi.
All summer long, Vianne hid Rachel's son in Les Jardins. She made sure never to venture out with him, not even to garden. Without papers, she couldn't pretend he was anyone other than Ariel de Champlain. She had to let Sophie stay at home with the child, and so each journey to town was a nerve-wracking event that couldn't be over soon enough. She told everyone she could think of, shopkeepers, nuns, villagers, that Rachel had been deported with both her children. It was all she could think of to do. Today, after a long, slogging day, standing in line, only to be told there was nothing left, Vianne left town feeling defeated. There were rumors of more deportations, more roundups, happening all over France. Thousands of French Jews were being held at internment camps. At home, she hung her wet cloak on an exterior hook by the front door. She had no real hope that it would dry out before tomorrow, but at least it wouldn't drip all over her floor. She stepped out of her muddy rubber boots by the door and went into the house. As usual, Sophie was standing by the door, waiting for her.
"I'm fine," Vianne said.
Sophie nodded solemnly.
"So are we. Will you give Ari a bath while I make supper?"
Sophie scooped Ari into her arms and left the room. Vianne uncoiled the scarf from her hair and hung it up. Then she set her basket in the sink to dry out and went down to the pantry, where she chose a sausage and some undersized softening potatoes and onions. Back in the kitchen, she lit the stove and preheated her black cast-iron skillet. Adding a drop of the precious oil, she browned the sausage. Vianne stared down at the meat, breaking it up with her wooden spoon, watching it turn from pink to gray to a nice crusty brown. When it was crispy, she added cubed potatoes and diced onions and garlic. The garlic popped and browned and released its scent into the air.
"That smells delicious. Herr Captain," she said quietly. "I didn't hear your motorcycle. Mademoiselle Sophie let me in."
She turned down the flame on the stove and covered the pan, then faced him. By tacit agreement, they both pretended that the night in the orchard had never happened. Neither had mentioned it, and yet it was in the air between them, always. Things had changed that night, subtly. He ate supper with them most nights now, mostly food that he brought home. Never large amounts, just a ham slice or a bag of flour or a few sausages. He spoke openly of his wife and children, and she talked about Antoine. All their words were designed to reinforce the wall that had already been breached. He repeatedly offered, most kindly, to mail Vianne's care packages to Antoine, which he filled with whatever small items she could spare. Old winter gloves that were too big, cigarettes Beck left behind, a precious jar of jam. Vianne made sure never to be alone with Beck. That was the biggest change. She didn't go out to the backyard at night or stay up after Sophie went to bed. She didn't trust herself to be alone with him.
"I have brought you a gift," he said.
He held out a set of papers, a birth certificate for a baby born in June of 1939, to Etienne and Aimé Mauriac, a boy named Daniel Antoine Mauriac. Vianne looked at Beck. Had she told him that she and Antoine had wanted to name a son Daniel? She must have, although she didn't remember it. It is unsafe to house Jewish children now, or it will be very soon.
"You have taken such a risk for him, for us," she said.
"For you," he said quietly. "And they are false papers, madame. Remember that. To go along with the story that you adopted him from a relative."
"I will never tell them they came from you."
"It is not myself I worry about, madame. Ari must become Daniel immediately, completely, and you must be extremely careful. The Gestapo and the SS are brutes. The Allied victories in Africa are hitting us hard, and this final solution for the Jews, it is an evil impossible to even comprehend. He paused, gazed down at her. "I want to protect you."
"You have," she said, looking up at him.
He started to move toward her, and she to him, even as she knew it was a mistake. Sophie came running into the kitchen.
"Ari is hungry, Maman. He keeps complaining." Beck came to a stop. Reaching past her, brushing her arm with his hand, he picked up a fork on the counter. Taking it, he speared one perfect bite of sausage, a crispy brown cube of potato, a chunk of caramelized onion. As he ate it, he stared down at her. He was so close now, she could feel his breath on her cheek. "You are a most amazing cook, madame."
"Merci," she said in a tight voice.
He stepped back. "I regret I cannot stay for supper, madame. I must away." Vianne tore her gaze away from him and smiled at Sophie. "Set the table for three," she said. Later, while supper simmered on the stove, Vianne gathered the children together on their bed.
"Sophie, Ari, come here. I need to speak with you."
"What is it, maman?" Sophie asked, looking worried already.
"They are deporting French-born Jews," she paused. "Children, too."
Sophie drew in a sharp breath and looked at 3-year-old Ari, who bounced happily on the bed. He was too young to learn a new identity. She could tell him his name was Daniel Moriac from now until forever, and he wouldn't understand why. If he believed in his mother's return and waited for that, sooner or later he would make a mistake that would get him deported, maybe one that would get them all killed. She couldn't risk that. She would have to break his heart to protect them all.
"Forgive me, Rachel."
She and Sophie exchanged a pained look. They both knew what had to be done, but how could one mother do this to another woman's child?
"Ari," she said quietly, taking his face in her hands,
"your maman is with the angels in heaven. She won't be coming back." He stopped bouncing.
"What?"
"She's gone forever," Vianne said again, feeling her own tears rise and fall. She would say it over and over until he believed it. "I am your maman now, and you will be called Daniel." He frowned, chewing noisily on the inside of his mouth, splaying his fingers as if he were counting.
"You said she was coming back."
Vianne hated to say it. "She's not. She's gone. Like the sick baby rabbit we lost last month, remember?" They had buried it in the yard with great ceremony.
"Gone like the bunny?"
Tears filled his brown eyes, spilled over. His mouth trembled. Vianne took him in her arms and held him and rubbed his back. But she couldn't soothe him enough, nor could she let him go. At last, she eased back enough to look at him.
"Do you understand, Daniel?"
"You'll be my brother," Sophie said, her voice unsteady.
"Truly."
Vianne felt her heart break, but she knew there was no other way to keep Rachel's son safe. She prayed that he was young enough to forget he was ever Ari, and the sadness of that prayer was overwhelming.
"Say it," she said evenly. "Tell me your name."
"Daniel," he said, obviously confused, trying to please. Vianne made him say it a dozen times that night, while they ate their supper of sausage and potatoes, and later, when they washed the dishes and dressed for bed. She prayed that this ruse would be enough to save him, that his papers would pass inspection. Never again would she call him Ari, or even think of him as Ari. Tomorrow, she would cut his hair as short as possible. Then she would go to town and tell everyone that gossip, Helene Riel, would be the first, of the child she'd adopted from a dead cousin in Nice. God help them all. Chapter 25. Isabel crept through the empty streets of Caraveau, dressed in black, her golden hair covered. It was after curfew. A meager moon occasionally cast light on the uneven cobblestones. More often, it was obscured by clouds. She listened for footsteps and lorry motors and froze when she heard either. At the end of town, she climbed over a rose-covered wall, heedless of the thorns, and dropped into a wet black field of hay. She was halfway to the rendezvous point when 3 aeroplanes roared overhead, so low in the sky the trees shivered and the ground shook. Machine guns fired at one another, bursts of sound and light. The small aeroplane banked and swerved. She saw the insignia of America on the underside of its wing as it banked left and climbed. Moments later, she heard the whistling of a bomb, the inhuman, piercing wail, and then something exploded. The airfield. They were bombing it. The aeroplanes roared overhead again. There was another round of gunfire, and the American aeroplane was hit. Smoke roiled out. A screaming sound filled the night. The aeroplane plummeted toward the ground, twirled, its wings catching the moonlight, reflecting it. It crashed hard enough to rattle Isabel's bones and shake the ground beneath her feet, steel hitting dirt, rivets popping from metal, roots being torn up. The broken aeroplane skidded through the forest, breaking trees as if they were matchsticks. The smell of smoke was overwhelming, and then, in a giant whoosh, the aeroplane burst into flames. In the sky, a parachute appeared, swinging back and forth, the man suspended beneath it looking as small as a comma. Isabel cut through the swath of burning trees. Smoke stung her eyes. Where was he? A glimpse of white caught her eye, and she ran toward it. The limp parachute lay across the scrubby ground, the airmen attached to it. Isabel heard the sound of voices. They weren't far away, and the crunching of footsteps. She hoped to God it was her colleagues coming for the meeting, but there was no way to know. The Nazis would be busy at the airfield, but not for long. She skidded to her knees, unhooked the airman's parachute, gathered it up, and ran with it as far as she dared, burying it as best she could beneath a pile of dead leaves. Then she ran back to the pilot and grabbed him by the wrists and dragged him deeper into the woods. "You'll have to stay quiet. Do you understand me? I'll come back, but you need to lie still and be quiet." "You betcha," he said, his voice barely a whisper. Isabel covered him with leaves and branches, but when she stood back, she saw her footprints in the mud, each one oozing with black water now, and the rutted drag marks she made hauling him over here. Black smoke rolled past her, engulfed her. The fire was getting closer, burning brighter. "Merde," she muttered. There were voices, people yelling. She tried to rub her hands clean, but the mud just smeared and smeared, marking her. Three shapes came out of the woods, moving toward her. "Isabel," a man said. "Is that you?" A torchlight flicked on, revealing Henri and Didier and Gaetan. "You found the pilot?" Henri asked. Isabel nodded. "He's wounded." Dogs barked in the distance. The Nazis were coming. Didier glanced behind him. "We haven't much time." "We'll never make it to town," Henri said. Isabel made a split-second decision. "I know somewhere close we can hide him." "This is not a good idea," Gaetan said. "Hurry," Isabel said harshly. They were in the barn at Le Jardin now, with the door shut behind them. The airman lay slumped on the dirty floor, unconscious, his blood smearing across Didier's coat and gloves. "Push the car forward." Henri and Didier pushed the Renault forward and then lifted the cellar door. It creaked in protest and fell forward and banged into the car's fender. Isabel lit an oil lamp and held it in one hand as she felt her way down the wobbly ladder. Some of the provisions she'd left had been used. She lifted the lamp. "Bring him down." The men exchanged a worried look. "I don't know about this," Henri said. "What choice do we have?" Isabel snapped. "Now bring him down." Gaetan and Henri carried the unconscious airman down into the dark, dank cellar and laid him on the mattress, which made a rustly, whispery sound beneath his weight. Henri gave her a worried look. Then he climbed out of the cellar and stood above them. "Come on, Gaetan." Gaetan looked at Isabel. "We'll have to move the car back into place. You won't be able to get out of here until we come for you. If something happened to us, no one would know you were here." She could tell he wanted to touch her, and she ached for it, but they stood where they were, their arms at their sides. "The Nazis will be relentless in their search for this airman. If you're caught..." She tilted her chin, trying to hide how scared she was. "Don't let me be caught." "You think I don't want to keep you safe?" "I know you do," she said quietly. Before he could answer, Henri said, "Come on, Gaetan," from above. "We need to find a doctor and figure out how to get them out of here tomorrow." Gaetan stepped back. The whole world seemed to lie in that small space between them. "When we come back, we'll knock three times and whistle, so don't shoot us." "I'll try not to," she said. He paused. "Isabel." She waited, but he had no more to say, just her name, spoken with the kind of regret that had become common. With a sigh, he turned and climbed up the ladder. Moments later, the trapdoor banged shut. She heard the boards overhead groan as the Renault was rolled back into place, and then silence. Isabel started to panic. It was a locked bedroom again, Madame Doom slamming the door, clicking the lock, telling her to shut up and quit asking for things. She couldn't get out of here, not even in an emergency. Stop it. Be calm. You know what needs to be done. She went over to the shelving, pushed her father's shotgun aside, and retrieved the box of medical supplies. A quick inventory revealed scissors, a needle and thread, alcohol, bandages, chloroform, Benzedrine tablets, and adhesive tape. She knelt beside the airman and set the lamp down on the floor beside her. Blood soaked the chest of his flight suit, and it took great effort to peel the fabric away. When she did, she saw the giant gaping hole in his chest and knew there was nothing she could do. She sat beside him, holding his hand, until he took one last troubled breath. Then his breathing stopped. His mouth slowly gaped open. She gently eased the dog tags from around his neck. They would need to be hidden. She looked down at them. "Lieutenant Keith Johnson," she said. Isabel blew out the lamp and sat in the dark with the dead man. The next morning, Vianne dressed in denim overalls and a flannel shirt of Antoine's that she had cut down to fit her. She was so thin these days that still the shirt overwhelmed her slim frame. She would have to take it in again. Her latest care package to Antoine sat on the kitchen counter, ready to be mailed. Sophie had had a restless night, so Vianne let her sleep. She went downstairs to make coffee and almost ran into Captain Beck, who was pacing the living room. "Oh, Herr Captain, I am sorry." He seemed not to hear her. She had never seen him look so agitated. His usually pomaded hair was untended. A lock kept falling in his face, and he cursed repeatedly as he brushed it away. He was wearing his gun, which he never did in the house. He strode past her, his hands fisted at his sides. Anger contorted his handsome face, made him almost unrecognizable. "An aeroplane went down near here last night," he said, facing her at last. "An American aeroplane, the one they call a Mustang. I thought you wanted their aeroplanes to go down. Isn't that why you shoot at them?" "We searched all night and didn't find a pilot. Someone is hiding him." "Hiding him? Oh, I doubt that. Most likely he died." "Then there would be a body, madame. We found a parachute, but no body." "But who would be so foolish?" Vianne said. "Don't you execute people for that?" "Swiftly." Vianne had never heard him speak in such a way. It made her draw back and remember the whip he'd held on the day Rachel and the others were deported. "Forgive my manner, madame, but we have shown you all our best behaviors, and this is what we get from many of you French, lies and betrayal and sabotage." Vianne's mouth dropped open in shock. He looked at her, saw how she was staring at him, and he tried to smile. "Forgive me again. I don't mean you, of course. The commandant is blaming me for this failure to find the airman. I am charged with doing better today." He went to the front door, opened it. Through the open door she saw a glimpse of gray-green in her yard. Soldiers. "Good day, madame." Vianne followed him as far as the front step. "Lock and close all the doors, madame. This pilot may be desperate. You wouldn't want him to break into your home." Vianne nodded numbly. Beck joined his entourage of soldiers and took the lead. Their dogs barked loudly, strained forward, sniffing at the ground along the base of the broken wall. Vianne glanced up the hill and saw that the barn door was partially open. "Herr Captain," she called out. The captain stopped. So did his men. The snarling dogs strained at their leashes. And then she thought of Rachel. This is where Rachel would come if she'd escaped. "Nothing, Herr Captain," Vianne called out. He nodded brusquely and led his men up the road. Vianne slipped into the boots by the door. As soon as the soldiers were out of sight, she hurried up the hill toward the barn. In her haste, she slipped twice in the wet grass and nearly fell. Righting herself at the last minute, she took a deep breath and opened the barn door all the way. She noticed right away that the car had been moved. "I'm coming, Rachel," she said. She put the car in neutral and rolled it forward until the cellar door was revealed. Squatting down, she fell for the flat metal handle and lifted the hatch door. When it was high, she let it bang against the car fender. She got a lantern, lit it, and peered down into the dark cellar. "Rach?" "Go away, Vianne. Now!" "Isabel?" Vianne descended the ladder, saying, "Isabel, what are—" She dropped to the ground and turned, the lantern in her hand swinging light. Her smile faded. Isabel's dress was covered in blood. Her blonde hair was a mess, full of leaves and twigs, and her face was so scratched it looked like she'd gone running in a blackberry patch. But that wasn't the worst of it. "The pilot," Bian whispered, staring at the man lying on the misshapen mattress. It scared her so much she backed into the shelving. Something clanged to the ground and rolled. "The one they're looking for. You shouldn't have come down here." "I am the one who shouldn't be here? You fool! Do you know what they'll do to us if they find him here? How could you bring this danger to my house?" "I'm sorry. Just close the cellar door and put the car back in place. Tomorrow, when you wake up, we'll be gone." "You're sorry?" Vian said. Anger swept through her. How dare her sister do this thing, put Sophie and her at risk? And now there was Ari here, who still didn't understand that he needed to be Daniel. "You'll get us all killed." Vian backed away, reached for the ladder. She had to put as much distance as she could between herself and this airman, and her reckless, selfish sister. "Be gone by tomorrow morning, Isabel, and don't come back." Isabel had the nerve to look wounded. "But don't," Vian snapped. "I'm done making excuses for you. I was mean to you as a girl. Maman died. Papa is a drunk. Madame Dumas treated you badly. All of it is the truth, and I have longed to be a better sister to you. But that stops here. You are as thoughtless and reckless as always, only now you will get people killed. I can't let you endanger Sophie. Do not come back. You are not welcome here. If you return, I will turn you in myself." On that, Vian clambered up the ladder and slammed the cellar door shut behind her. Vian had to keep busy, or she would fall into a full-blown panic. She woke the children and fed them a light breakfast and got started on her chores. After harvesting the last of the autumn's vegetables, she pickled cucumbers and zucchini and canned some pumpkin puree. All the while, she was thinking about Isabel and the airmen in the barn. What should be done? The question haunted her all day, reasserting itself constantly. Every choice was dangerous. Obviously, she should just keep quiet about the airmen in the barn. Silence was always safest. But what if Beck and the Gestapo and the SS and their dogs went into the barn on their own? If Beck found the airman in a barn on the property where he was billeted, the commandant would not be pleased. Beck would be humiliated. "The commandant is blaming me for this failure to find the airmen." Humiliated men could be dangerous. Maybe she could tell Beck. He was a good man. He had tried to save Rachel. He had gotten Ari papers. He mailed Vianne's care packages to her husband. Perhaps Beck could be convinced to take the airmen and leave Isabel out of it. The airmen would be sent to a prisoner of war camp. That was not so bad. She was still grappling with these questions long after supper had ended, and she put the children to bed. She didn't even try to go to sleep. How could she sleep with a family at such risk? The thought of that made her anger with Isabel swell again. At 10 o'clock, she heard footsteps out front and a sharp rap-rap on the door. She put down her darning and got to her feet. Smoothing the hair back from her face, she went to the door and opened it. Her hands were trembling so badly she fisted them at her side. "Herr Captain," she said, "you are late. Shall I make you something to eat?" He muttered, "No, thank you," and pushed past her, rougher than he'd ever been before. He went into his room and came back with a bottle of brandy. Pouring himself a huge draught in a chipped cafe glass, he downed the liquid and poured himself another. "Herr Captain." "We didn't find the pilot," he said, downing the second drink, pouring a third. "Oh, these Gestapo," he looked at her. "They'll kill me," he said quietly. "No, surely. They do not like to be disappointed." He drank the third glass of brandy and slammed the glass down on the table, almost breaking it. "I have looked everywhere," he said, "every nook and cranny of this godforsaken town. I've looked in cellars and basements and chicken pens, in thickets of thorns and under piles of garbage. And what do I have to show for my efforts? A parachute with blood on it and no pilot." "Surely you haven't looked everywhere," she said to console him. "Shall I get you something to eat? I saved you some supper." He stopped suddenly. She saw his gaze narrow, heard him say, "It is not possible, but—" He grabbed a torchlight and strode to the closet in the kitchen and yanked the door open. "What are you doing? I am searching your house." "Surely you don't think—" She stood there, her heart thumping as he searched from room to room, and yanked the coats out of the closet and pulled the divan away from the wall. "Are you satisfied?"
"Satisfied, madame? We lost 14 pilots this week, and God knows how many aeroplane crew. A Mercedes-Benz factory was blown up 2 days ago, and all the workers were killed. My uncle works in that building. Worked, I suppose."
"I'm sorry," she said. Bianne drew in a deep breath, thinking it was over, and then she saw that he was going outside. Did she make a sound? She was afraid that she did. She surged after him, wanting to grab his sleeve, but she was too late. He was outside now, following the beam of his torchlight, the kitchen door standing open behind him. She ran after him. He was at the dove cote, yanking the door open.
"Herr Captain!"
She slowed, tried to calm her breathing as she rubbed her damp palms down her pant legs.
"You will not find anything or anyone here, Herr Captain. You must know that."
"Are you a liar, madame?"
He was not angry. He was afraid.
"No, you know I am not, Wolfgang," she said, using his Christian name for the first time. "Surely your superiors will not blame you."
"This is the problem with you, French," he said. "You fail to see the truth when it sits down beside you."
He pushed past her and walked up the hill toward the barn. He would find Isabel and the airmen, and if he did, prison for all of them. Maybe worse. He would never believe that she didn't know about it. She had already shown too much to go back to innocence, and it was too late now to rely on his honor in saving Isabel. Vianne had lied to him. He opened the barn door and stood there, his hands on his hips, looking around. He put down his torchlight and lit an oil lamp. Setting it down, he checked every inch of the barn, each stall in the hayloft.
You see," Vianne said. "Now come back to the house. Perhaps you'd like another brandy."
He looked down. There were faint tire tracks in the dust.
"You said once that Madame Champlain hid in a cellar."
"No." Vianne meant to say something, but when she opened her mouth, nothing came out. He opened the Renault's door, put the car in neutral, and pushed it forward, rolling it far enough to reveal the cellar door.
"Captain, please."
He bent down in front of her. His fingers moved along the floor, searching the creases for the edges of the hatch. If he opened that door, it was over. He would shoot Isabel or take her into custody and send her to prison. And Vianne and the children would be arrested. There would be no talking to him, no convincing him. Beck unholstered his gun, cocked it. Vianne looked desperately for a weapon, saw a shovel leaned against the wall. He lifted the hatch and yelled something. As the door banged open, he stood up, taking aim. Vianne grabbed the shovel and swung it at him with all of her strength. The metal scoop made a sickening thunk as it hit him in the back of the head and sliced deeply into his skull. Blood spurted down the back of his uniform. At the same time, two shots rang out, one from Beck's gun and one from the cellar. Beck staggered sideways and turned. There was a hole the size of an onion in his chest, spurting blood. A flap of hair and scalp hung over one eye.
"Madame," he said, crumpling to his knees. His pistol clattered to the floor. The torchlight rolled across the uneven boards, clattering.
Vianne threw the shovel aside and knelt down beside Beck, who lay sprawled, face first, in a pool of his blood. Using all of her weight, she rolled him over. He was pale already, chalkily so. Blood clotted his hair, streaked down his nostrils, bubbled at every breath he took.
"I'm sorry," Vianne said.
Beck's eyes fluttered open. Vianne tried to wipe the blood off his face, but it just made more of a mess. Her hands were red with it now.
"I had to stop you," she said quietly.
"Tell my family." Vianne saw the life leave his body, saw his chest stop rising, his heart stop beating. Behind her, she heard her sister climbing up the ladder.
"Vianne."
Vianne couldn't move.
"Are you all right?"
Isabel asked in a breathless, wheezing voice. She looked pale and a little shaky.
"I killed him. He's dead," Vianne said.
"No, you didn't." "I shot him in the chest," Isabel said. "I hit him in the head with a shovel."
"A shovel?"
Isabel moved toward her. "Vianne." "Don't," Vianne said sharply. "I don't want to hear some excuse from you. Do you know what you've done? A Nazi, dead in my barn." Before Isabel could answer, there was a loud whistle, and then a mule-drawn wagon entered the barn. Vianne lurched for Beck's weapon, staggered to her feet on the blood-slick floorboards, and pointed the gun at the strangers.
"Vianne, don't shoot," Isabel said. "They're friends."
Vianne looked at the ragged-looking men in the wagon, then at her sister, who was dressed all in black and looked milky pale, with shadows under her eyes. "Of course they are." She moved sideways, but kept the gun trained on the men, crowded onto the front of the rickety wagon. Behind them, in the bed of the wagon, lay a pine coffin. She recognized Henri, the man who ran the hotel in town, with whom Isabel had run off to Paris, the communist with whom Isabel thought she might be in love a little. "Of course," Vianne said. "You're a lover." Henri jumped down from the wagon and closed the barn door. "What in the fuck happened?" "Vianne hit him with a shovel, and I shot him," Isabel said. "There's some sisterly dispute on who killed him, but he's dead. Captain Beck, the soldier who billets here." Henri exchanged a look with one of the strangers, a scrappy, sharp-faced young man with hair that was too long. "That's a problem," the man said. "Can you get rid of the body?" Isabel asked. She was pressing a hand to her chest as if her heart was beating too fast. "And the airman's, too. He didn't make it." A big, shaggy man in a patched coat and pants that were too small jumped down from the wagon. "Disposing of the bodies is the easy part." "Who were these people?" Isabel nodded. "They'll come looking for Beck. My sister can't stand up to questioning. We'll need to put her and Sophie in hiding." That did it. They were talking about Vianne as if she weren't even here. Running would only prove my guilt. "You can't stay," Isabel said. "It isn't safe." "By all means, Isabel, worry about me now, after you've put me and the children at risk and forced me to kill a decent man. Vianne, please." Vianne felt something in her harden. It seemed that every time she thought she'd hit rock bottom in this war, something worse came along. Now she was a murderess, and it was Isabel's fault. The last thing she was going to do now was follow her sister's advice and leave Le Jardin. "I will say that Beck left to look for the airmen and never returned. What do I, an ordinary French housewife, know of such things? He was here, and then he was gone. C'est la vie." "It is as good an answer as any," Henri said. "This is my fault," Isabel said, approaching Vianne. She saw her sister's regret for this and her guilt, but Vianne didn't care. She was too scared for the children to worry about Isabel's feelings. "Yes, it is, but you made it mine, too. We killed a good man, Isabel." Isabel swayed a little unsteady. "V, they'll come for you." Vianne started to say, "And whose fault is that?" But when she looked at Isabel, the words caught in her throat. She saw blood oozing out from between Isabel's fingers. For a split second, the world slowed down, tilted, became nothing but noise. The men talking behind her, the mule stomping his hoof on the wooden floor. Her own labored breathing. Isabel crumpled to the floor, unconscious. Before Vianne could even cry out, a hand clamped over her mouth. Arms yanked her back. The next thing she knew, she was being dragged away from her sister. She wrestled to be free, but the man holding her was too strong. She saw Henri drop to his knees beside Isabel and rip open her coat and blouse to reveal a bullet hole just below her collarbone. Henri tore off his shirt and pressed it to the wound. Vianne elbowed her captor hard enough to make him oof. She wrenched free and rushed to Isabel's side, slipping in the blood, almost falling. "There's a medical kit in the cellar." The dark-haired man, who suddenly looked as shaky as Vianne felt, leaped down the cellar stairs and returned quickly, carrying the supplies. Vianne's hands were shaking as she reached for the bottle of alcohol and washed her hands as best she could. She took a deep breath and took over the job of pressing Henri's shirt against the wound, which he felt pulsing beneath her. Twice she had to draw back, wring blood out of the shirt, and start again, but finally the bleeding stopped. Gently, she rolled Isabel into her arms and saw the exit wound. Thank God. She carefully laid Isabel back down. "This is going to hurt," she whispered. "But you're strong, aren't you, Isabel?" She doused the wound with alcohol. Isabel shuddered at the contact, but she didn't waken or cry out. "That's good," Vianne said. The sound of her own voice calmed her, reminded her that she was a mother, and mothers took care of their families. Unconscious is good, she fished the needle from the medical kit, such as it was, and threaded it. She doused the needle in alcohol, and then leaned down to the wound. Very carefully, she began stitching the gaping flesh together. It didn't take long, and she hadn't done a good job, but it was the best she could do. Once she'd stitched the entrance wound, she felt a little confidence, enough to stitch the exit wound and then to bandage it. At last she sat back, staring down at her bloody hands and bloodied skirt. Isabel looked so pale and frail, not herself at all. Her hair was filthy and matted. Her clothes were wet with her own blood and the airmen's, and she looked young, so young. Vianne felt a shame so deep it made her sick to her stomach. Had she really told her sister, to go away and not come back? How often had Isabel heard that in her life and from her own family, from people who were supposed to love her? "I'll take her to the safe house in Breton," the black-haired one said. "Oh, no, you won't," Vianne said. She looked up from her sister, saw that the three men were standing together by the wagon, conspiring. She got to her feet. "She's not going anywhere with you. You're the reason she's here." "She's the reason we're here," the dark-haired man said. "I'm taking her. Now." We have come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.